And as Terry likes to say, stay frosty.
Especially now.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our top story today is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering the launch of Kingston's new food strategy.
The Food Policy Council for KFLNA is continuing its work towards a comprehensive regional food strategy, launching a series of five targeted focus groups over the coming weeks. In collaboration with Queen's University and other community partners, the council is embarking on consultations designed to better understand what communities across Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington need in order to build a sustainable and equitable local food system. These consultations will take a deeper dive into five key areas: rural food production, urban food production, food security, food retail and distribution, and food education and literacy. The first consultation, focused on rural food production, including farmers and market gardeners, took place on Monday. Members of the Food Policy Council co-chair Ellen Mortfield and Queen's University School of Environmental Studies assistant professor Kristen Lowitt sat down to discuss the launch of the consultation process and what it aims to achieve. Mortfield explained what's led the council to this stage in its work.
It's been quite a few years building to this point. Last year, working with Kristen and Queen's University, the Food Policy Council did secure a bit of funding to launch us on this process of starting a food strategy for Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington. So we've been slowly building. We had some more casual potluck events over the summer just to get the conversation started. And now we're conducting these kind of targeted focus groups with specific sectors within the food system. So last night was our first one with the rural food production folks. We had a good turnout. I think there's about 20, wasn't there, Kristen?
Yeah, I think probably, what, 14, 15 producers?
Yeah. And really interesting conversations, lots of ideas. We started to work towards prioritizing some of those ideas, some action items that we'll be able to pursue. And all of these sort of ideas and goals and objectives and action plans will be set out in the finished food strategy. But at this stage, we're just trying to make note of these ideas, get people connected so we can start pursuing some of these action items, and really make some significant improvements over the next few years in people's access to local food in this area. That's the big goal.
Following several informal meetings over the summer and now one completed consultation, Lowitt says the council is already beginning to identify key themes emerging from the discussions. Among them, the importance of connection across different sectors of the food system and the notion of building food sovereignty in the region.
We did begin, maybe I'll step back for a second, right, in terms of slightly bigger context. So the Food Policy Council has been around since just over 10 years, since around 2013. And I think its mandate when it started was to contribute to the community food system in this region. And I think over the summer and the informal potluck series you're referring to, and then, the first session we're having now, I think one of the biggest takeaways, at least for myself personally, is just like the importance of these sorts of forums or events for convening and gathering people in food systems that may not always have a chance to connect or speak to one another. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, people are busy, but there's also, you know, a lot of fragmentation, you know, between, you know, farmers or policymakers or people that are eating food or even teachers that might be teaching or whatever, right? So often there isn't really a way for a lot of these different actors to connect. And so I think that's been really powerful just in terms of sharing ideas. With, you know, with the farmers and food producers last night, for example, you know, and it became queer, you know, clear pretty quickly. There were some shared, you know, issues, concerns sort of in common, right? We had an extended kind of conversation about, you know, distribution and how do we scale up distribution of regional foods, right? And some common challenges experience with respect to, you know, building a bigger pool of customers and, you know, distributing more widely, right? So I think there's a really big need for these sort of convening. And that's kind of really what the Food Policy Council was meant to do, right? Because too often, you know, food is really sort of, the food system's often really kind of fragmented in terms of policy, you know, like health has a piece over here and then maybe agriculture somewhere else. And often, you know, it's under economic development or whatever, there often isn't a more integrated forum for discussing some of these issues and bringing them together and connecting some of the pieces. And so this summer was really valuable for that because we had folks from across the food system coming together. The focus group similarly, although we're focusing a little bit deeper now on kind of specific sort of aspects or questions and kind of groups in the food system. So I think that to me is one of the big takeaways and one of the big values. And, you know, the second would be, I think, related to that is hopefully, you know, this notion of sort of building food sovereignty, right? And in the kind of the larger food system, there's such a lack of control for farmers or fishers or eaters, right? Often in terms of, you know, where's the food coming from, who's growing it, who has control of inputs or seed supplies, you know, farmers being more, you know, price takers and these sorts of things, right? And being squeezed in different ways in value chains and just corporations and governments that are often, you know, complicit with what they want. Really not responding to the need of, you know, communities, of localities, of regional, more ecological food production, I want to call it that. So I think, that need to convene and hopefully feel like I think the local and the regional scales are really powerful in terms of building some of those connections, discussing shared issues and thinking about, you know, what can we do here? What are the assets and values we have here that allow us to build the food system in a more kind of food sovereign, you know, food system that the community, you know, kind of collectively wants.
As mentioned, the council has already gained insight into some of the key challenges and has begun brainstorming potential solutions based on feedback from participants in the first session.
We'll see the commonalities, I think, once we get more of the groups going. But in this first one, I think it was interesting to see some of the ideas that came out. Just people, you know, with this shared experience of in local food production. Some of the things that were talked about is like a food hub or a food cooperative. Is that something that would be helpful to our farmers? Also, some of the issues, like one of our biggest problems here is not enough food being produced locally. Farmers are kind of aging out of the system and they're not being replaced by young people coming into farming. So that's an issue there. And then other things like difficulties with local bylaws and the differences in enforcement and bylaws, even in between the counties, like Lennox and Addington and Frontenac counties, have different ways of dealing with growth in food production and farm businesses. And so those are the sorts of difficulties that the folks that came out to participate last night, those are the kinds of things that they were talking about.
Looking ahead, Mortfield and Lowitz say the next steps will be analyzing the information gathered and beginning to develop concrete action items once the sessions wrap up in early February.
Our hope is that we can kind of prioritize some of these ideas and actions on, you know, the quick wins, the ones that are going to take a few years of work. And we need to identify who needs to be involved to move these forward. And there's lots of work to be done, but setting some goals, you know, having a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, and people at the table that are willing to tackle some of these, that's what we want to achieve out of these sessions.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, you know, the discussions and these focus groups have started to, you know, we've done kind of some of the larger sort of visioning exercises, and now we're really starting to focus on, you know, some of the concrete and tangible actions that communities, organizations, citizens in the food system can take and would like to see. So we've started to do some of that kind of actioning and prioritizing. And I think there's a lot of really, you know, concrete kind of proposals that came up even just in the session last night, right? Like, for example, is there potential to establish a food hub? We spent some time talking about, you know, a cooperative grocery store. There's another really tangible example. We had a representative from Cassie, the Kingston Area Seed Saving Initiative in attendance, who, you know, really was encouraging members of the community to grow out some of their local and traditional seeds, right? That's a really tangible action, right? That gardeners or school gardeners or farmers can take up, right? So I think we have some really kind of tangible examples, and there's, you know, it's fantastic for our council too, because I think this is the start of a process, right? It's sort of a food strategy, so then we can also identify, you know, some of these, you know, short, medium term, maybe longer term sort of policy actions or initiatives that we want to kind of collectively sort of work on or continue to convene, right, with these other groups in the food system and try to move ahead, right, coming out of this food strategy process.
Several consultations are still on the horizon. The Urban Food Production Consultation, focused on community gardeners, urban agriculture, and food forests, takes place Monday, January 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. The Food Security Consultation, centered on charitable and emergency food access, will follow on Monday, January 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Food retail and distribution, including restaurants and local food outlets and markets, will be the focus on Monday, February 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. The final consultation on food education and literacy involving school boards, public health, and educators takes place Monday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. Community researcher Ayla Fenton is coordinating all 5 sessions. Those interested in participating in a consultation relevant to their work are encouraged to contact her at aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. That's aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, and it covers a possible traffic study of Garden Street in Gananoque.
Thank you, Jesse. Gananoque Town Council is set to review a report on proposed traffic calming measures for Garden Street at its Wednesday meeting, with staff recommending a traffic impact study before any changes are made. The study would examine options to reduce speed limits and improve safety on the residential street, particularly between Herbert Street and Talbot Place. The initiative stems from a request late last August by resident Richard Ferguson, who suggested speed bumps, a lower speed limit, and additional stops to improve safety. Council initially directed staff to investigate the proposal in August 2025, but the report was postponed in December due to time constraints and is now being presented for consideration. The affected block of Garden Street is approximately 205 meters long, with an 18-meter right-of-way, and sees an average of 131 vehicles per day, according to 2022 traffic data. In comparison, other sections of Garden Street and nearby Talbot Place experience higher traffic volumes, with daily counts ranging from 194 to 445 vehicles. Staff has explored several potential solutions, including installing speed bumps or stop signs, converting the intersection at Talbot Place into a dead end, or returning Garden Street to two-way traffic from Herbert Street to Wilson Drive. While each option is feasible, staff stresses that implementing changes without a full understanding of their impact could create unintended traffic issues in the area. To address this, staff is recommending that the town contract a qualified consultant to conduct a traffic impact study. The study, estimated to cost approximately $10,000, would provide recommendations based on best practices for street design and traffic management. It could also include an assessment of nearby streets, including King Street East and Wilson Drive, which are slated for realignment as part of future development south of Elmwood Drive. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a sports story about a Queensgale football player who is receiving receiving draft interest from both the CFL and NFL.
Thank you, Dinah. After an outstanding season serving as the blindside blocker for the Queens Gaels, All-Canadian tackle Nicholas Hennig was invited to the 2026 College Gridiron Showcase. Held in Fort Worth, Texas, the Gridiron Showcase is an annual event designed to shine a spotlight on some of the hidden gem prospects for both the CFL and NFL draft. Last year, Canadian quarterback Taylor Elgersma's performance was so strong that it resulted in him receiving an invitation to the Senior Bowl, an event usually reserved for only the best and brightest American college football players. Nick Hennig was one of 16 Canadian players selected for the Gridiron Showcase, and the early buzz coming out of Fort Worth is that he had the strongest performance of the bunch. Hennig, a former H-back turned tackle, boasts some impressive physical intangibles. Standing 6'5" and weighing in at a shade under 300 pounds, Hennig possesses an unusual level of athleticism and agility for a man of his size, thanks to his days of playing H-back. Though scouts noted that there were still some technical inconsistencies to his game, his imposing frame and explosive athleticism make him a prospect with a lot of potential moving forward. Canadian football scout J.C. Abbott, who was there in Texas to cover the Canadian contingent, stated that he feels that Hennig is the, quote, odds-on favorite to be the first U-Sports player selected in the upcoming CFL draft. He added that, should Hennig perform well at the March Combine, an NFL minicamp invite may be in his future as well. Nicholas Hennig still has one more season of U-Sports football eligibility with the Gaels, but he may choose to move on and pursue what could be a very promising professional football career.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the impact the BCG STEM grant has had in Loyalist Township.
BGC Southeast's first round of STEM field trips were a success, according to the organization. Between September and December 2025, over 500 students from schools in Loyalist Township visited BGC's STEM and Robotics Center. Students from grades 5 through 12 were able to take part in free field trips funded by a community grant from Loyalist Township. Associate Director of STEM and Strategic Initiatives at BGC Southeast, Bruna Guarino-Marais, explained how the Loyalist Township community grant helped them organize the field trips.
We got a Loyalist Township, the community grant, which is how we were able to do this project. We had never done it before, but I would say that normally we don't get 500 kids in field trips, but yeah, it was very successful. I think having the Loyalist community grant be able to fund this, we were able to offer everything for free to all the schools. So we had the BGC bus, so we had transportation, we had all the staffing materials. So we arranged everything for the school. So everyone that we reached out to was really willing to and excited to come. We really wanted to reach everyone. So that was really nice that we were able to get a class from Amherst Island. So they took the ferry and our bus met them at the ferry and brought them to BGC and then dropped them off at the ferry again. We were able to reach all the schools in Loyalist Township, which was really, really nice to see.
Guarino-Marais talks about what the students experience on the field trips.
It obviously varies a little bit depending on their age range, but really we were doing like hands-on workshops in robotics, coding, and 3D design and fabrication. So they varied a little bit, but most of them, they were using they're these like Lego Spike Prime robotics kits. So they get to build robots, and then they also get to do like coding to program the robots. And then they also got to do a CAD design session where they were designing their own keychains, for example. And then we were printing them off in our 3D printer, and they got to go home with it as well, which was nice. And then just getting a tour as well of the STEM Center, because a lot of the kids had never been here before. And even though, of course, it's a little bit far for Loyalist residents, it's still really nice that they know that they have this resource available.
Guarino-Marais went on to note the interest from students and teachers.
Afterwards, we had some teachers reaching out wanting to book more field trips or you know, then they learned that we have our after school evening STEM and robotics programs. And so a lot of the kids wanted to know more about that, and some of them even signed up. So it was just really nice for them to learn about this resource in the community. Teachers were sending us like emails after the sessions, like completely unprompted, like, oh, the kids were like singing on the bus back to school and things like that. So that was just really, really heartfelt when, you know, we're not asking for testimonials. They're just kind of thanking us and giving us some praise. So it just, you know, it helps us keep going.
Guarino Moraes talks about the importance of funding going forward.
The constraint is really just the funding. We would love to do it for free, but finding that sustainable source of funding is important. I think with the Loyalist Township grant, we definitely are looking forward to applying for it again, at least next year. But in the time being, like, we saw how successful this was and how much the kids enjoyed it and learned from it. So we're looking at other opportunities. I mean, we obviously can't offer we do like field trips for a small cost where parents can pay a little bit for their kids to come, but it obviously becomes a bit of an obstacle, but that is always an option until we find more grants to support this.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about local reactions to the removal of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Coburg, Ontario. Despite Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro being arrested and displaced from his position, a Trent Hills man who was born in the South American country says life will become much harder for his fellow countrymen before it gets better. Emilio Ojeda says taking out Maduro but not replacing the current administration will do little to change the situation.
I was born and raised in Venezuela, and I moved to Canada in 2007 after living a few years in the United States, in New York.
Obviously, the news of the President Maduro being arrested in early January shocked the world. What's your take on that situation?
To be honest, I believe that this is just, you know, a circus just mounted by President Trump to get away with same files. And that is because took Maduro and Maduro's wife, but he didn't change anybody else. So, yeah, he took one of the actors, but he left the rest of the actors there. In other words, nothing has changed at all. People are still having trouble. People are still disappearing. People are still having, have to be in line for hours to get a piece of meat or, you know, any of the basic staples to survive. People still have to pay everything with American dollars, and people there don't earn in American dollars. They still earn in Bolivar. So the situation is exactly the same, hasn't changed anything. You know, it's not even about the oil. I have some confrontations with friends and family and people from Venezuela that, they don't care about the oil as long as they are free. It's a high price to pay because, again, Venezuela has one of the biggest reserves of oil in the world. However, that oil is very heavy, and it costs a lot of money to refine. You have to build a special refinery. Unfortunately, the regime in Venezuela didn't invest in modernization of the plants there, and they are all growing. They are not working. So it's a shame because Venezuela used to live from that. I would like to take this opportunity to make sure people understand that saying that Venezuela regime is a socialist or right or any spectrum of the political ambience is not true. They are just bad actors in a facade of socialism, just stealing and the money produced by the Venezuelan oil that they can and taking and using the government asset to delivery drugs around the world. For instance, those little ships that were bombarded, that they were not. They are fishermen. They might have some drugs in there, but it's impossible for those little boats to go from Venezuela to the U.S. If there's no way. You need to ton of gas and hours. So so that was part of the search. That was part of the smoke gone to Trump administration to delivery with the attention from something bad and something worse.
Now, Emilio, in your discussions with family and friends in Venezuela, what are they telling you about the situation there on the ground?
They are tired, obviously. This situation has been in Venezuela for more than 20 years, and they were really excited that something was changing, although they came to realize already that it's not the case. Nothing has changed, and probably nothing will change. Again, the coming back to the oil, the American oil companies are not taking the Venezuelan oil because they don't want to invest an exceptional amount of money that they can they won't recover in years and years. So the situation there is, as you can see, is just a smoking gun for other stuff.
The international news coming out about Venezuela is that the vice president has been appointed, basically the interim head of state, and that the government still recognizes Nicolas Maduro as the president and that they are demanding his release. Do you see the current political structure worsening conditions for people? Like, do you think that there'll be a heavier crackdown given what happened with the United States coming in and arresting Maduro?
Of course. It's good to say that Del C. Rodriguez is part of the regime. She was the number two. And that's what I said. Nothing has changed. She's the new interim president. I'm going to call it that way. But to be honest, Maduro wasn't elected either. He took it by force. He changed the number. You know, I have information from even the center, the data center from the Electoral College in Caracas, that by 5 in the morning, the opposition candidate was 3-1. So suddenly in the early hours, that the whole thing changed in a national level. He's not, and most of the countries in the world hasn't accepted him as the legit president of Venezuela. And for him, the rest of the people is not legitimate. The problem here is that for these two be affected, everybody have to be changed. Everybody from the president to the police officers has to be changed. We have an infiltration of Cuban military in our own military. I haven't heard any country that allowed another country force take care of their own. So you can see the level of corruption right there. The cartel of the soul, the soul, the soul cartels, they're calling like that because the high officers in the military have, instead of stars, they have some souls. From solid, from tools, and they are the corrupt ones. They are the ones that are traveling using Venezuelan assets like ships and planes to bring the drug to anywhere in the world.
There's some hope that this incident may spark a call for democracy and more free elections. Are you hopeful for that? And are you seeing that in what you're hearing and experiencing back home?
No, I'm not. Honestly, I'm not hoping. I know that it won't be happening anytime soon. Here's what an anomaly said, that the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend. And you see that Trump's government have been very corrupt and very authoritarian. And do you think that government like that would actually help in the northern fleet. So this whole parody of intervention in another country definitely is going to be seen in other countries, thinking that like Iran right now, they think that the United States can come and take somebody out and everything going to be fine, and it's not the case. Things normally go for war, and history is a witness. Every time the U.S. trying to change the conditions in a country, everything goes for war. It happened in Chile, it happened in Panama, it happened in other places.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up on The Corridor, supported by local realtor Kim Purcell at kimpurcell.ca, is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 22nd, daytime high of -6 with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling closer to -11 with the wind chill. Friday, January 23rd, a little bit colder, daytime high of -9. But we will see less wind chill, so in the sun at the peak of the day, it'll actually feel a little closer to -4, even if the temperature is technically forecasted to be lower than Thursday. Saturday, January 24th, -8 is your high. Snowy, cold, feeling like -17. Sunday, January 25th, -14, with a wind chill feeling closer to -20. Little bit of sun, mostly clouds in the forecast. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, January 26th, high of -11, feeling like -20, with a 60% chance of snow in the forecast as well.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.
What Jeremy says, because I got my two Stanley Cup rings plug in my ear.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. We're here today with a little bit of a new crew. So it's Adam, your co-host, as always. Sam and Kyle, both absent today, being losers and not showing up to the show.
Unbelievable.
So we went with the B team. We got Dylan Katmarian, Ottawa native, five-time Queen's University student, and Mr. Aiden Peterson, our football expert. Welcome back to the show, Aiden, and welcome, Dylan, making your debut.
Yeah, Adam, thank you for welcoming me back. It's been kind of a lonely spot here on the left bench for this podcast, but I'm excited to get into the topics that we have today because I hear it's a hot one, and I hope people have their ears plugged in.
We do have a lot of interesting things to talk about today. We're going to be kind of all over the place. We've got some NHL news with the Senators. We're going to talk a little bit about the NFL playoffs. There were 2 weeks that we got to talk about the wild card and the divisional rounds, and then some AFCON news there. That's going to be really interesting to talk about. Some Senegal and Morocco drama going on. It's going to be a cool one to talk about.
What does AFCON stand for those who are not in the know?
African Cup of Nations.
Yes, wow. There we go. That is why he is the football/soccer expert. Okay, let's first talk about a more of a serious topic. The Ottawa Senators and their goaltending situation has been a hot kind of topic on our show. We've trashed them. Kyle, Sam, and I have trashed the Senators' goalies. And we maybe think we needed to take a step back because a lot of stuff came out today from Linus Allmark addressing his mental health situation, and it seems like he was having a really tough time on ice and off the ice. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good. Before we get into this, we're going to acknowledge that it is a major deal, mental health. It's not something that just can be shoved under the rug anymore. And as much as we are journalists, I say with air quotations. It is our job to be aware of the full situation, and I think that this clarity by Linus helps us a lot and to make our judgments. But I do think that it was playing a major role in his play. But I don't know if you guys got a chance to take a look at what he said.
No, I haven't seen it.
Essentially, he was talking a little bit about the panic attacks and anxiety attacks he was having mid-game. They ended up bringing in his junior trainer, I believe, from Sweden.
Wow.
Just to hang out with him and go for skates with him. Victor Hedman was apparently a really big help during the process. He was calling him up, and it sounds like it was pretty serious. So his leave of absence is definitely tough for Senators fans and for the team, but I mean, almost a necessary thing. I mean, I think about even like Carey Price and him taking his time off from Montreal. Like, everyone was kind of disappointed, right? But
yeah,
at the end of the day, you got to understand that these are like real people, right? And this is not the most easy sport or easy fan bases to please and to always have the best mental health. But Ottawa did have other situations with their goaltenders. Levi Marilainen has actually had to step up and play a lot of hockey for the Senators. Yeah. I think he played like 10 straight games,
like
something crazy like that.
Every time
I turned on the TV, he was there for better or for worse. He was between the pipes.
And he really did try his best, I think, but yeah. One defenseman on the Senators, Jake Sanderson, did not think so after the one game. He recently apologized for his comments.
Jake the Snake.
I think that's a new nickname that might stick around Sanderson. But Marilainen was sent back down to Belleville, so I think that maybe that's going to be good for him because he's a young guy. He's only 22 years old?
23.
Yeah. Like, he's got a lot of time to develop. Definitely was kind of thrust up there.
Rushed.
He was rushed.
They kind of threw him under the bus, but there was...
I don't really think they had another option with Ullmark taking a leave of absence. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I understand the frustration, but at the same time, when the guy's played 11 games in a row for you, it's a bit of a low blow. I understand both sides, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you, Dylan. Like, we're both Senators fans here, so we both want to see our team win, but at the same time, we understand, like you were saying beautifully with the Ullmark situation, was that they're people, too. And like I said previously on the show, I'm a goalie myself, and I've been in moments where I've been like vexed for periods of time during my play, and the teammates have been very good, very supportive. But there are those moments, especially when you have a consistent down period, that you need to kind of work your way up, which is why I think that him being sent down to Belleville is actually going to be good for him, just to get some experience, to get his feel back for the shots, because I think that's going to be very important.
Absolutely, and we saw Montreal do it with Montembeau earlier, too. They sent him down to Laval for a conditioning stint, and he came back up, and he's been playing better than he was before. So I think it can do wonders going back down to the lower level and just getting some confidence back.
So just to clarify, will Linus be returning to the lineup?
I actually didn't notice what the move was for goaltending for the Senators. I think they have Reimer still up.
Okay.
I don't know what the backup situation is like. I can take a look.
Backup situation currently, they're playing Columbus tonight, I believe, or when we're recording this. And the backup currently is Hunter Shepard.
Oh, yes.
Who I hope doesn't see the ice. But I think eventually they're trying to work Linus back into the lineup. But it's definitely not tonight. Maybe later this week or the week after. But he's on track.
Yeah, no. It does seem like him coming out and talking about all this stuff means that he's kind of on the tail end of his time away from the team.
Yeah.
So I do think it is. Hopefully, Hunter Shepard does not have to play. But I'm looking at his hockey DB right now, and I'm just trying to see how much experience this guy has. But he played a couple games for the Capitals over the last few years, and he's already played a game for the Senators this year too. So not a terrible option. In Belleville, he's played 13 games this year, so it almost seems like he was the backup in Belleville.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see how Reimer does. I'm really interested to see if he can kind of, I don't want to say turn back the clock, because he was kind of never great, but you know what I mean. Like, see if he can maybe have a vintage James Reimer season, and maybe bring the Senators back up to relevance again, as they're at the basement of the Atlantic Division right now. So
well, and you know, I'll cite my source as Instagram, but
from what I've seen, when the Sens receive even statistically average goaltending performances, they're one of the hardest to beat teams in the league. So we could really see a resurgence from them. They're quite low in the standings right now, but never too late to make a push.
But then again, like the low place in the standings, which they are, is only 6 points out of a wild card spot. So that's 3 wins. So if they do get the solid goaltending, and Reimer's first game against Detroit, it wasn't anything special. He looked old. He looked a little bit shaky, but
especially with being beaten clean there right for the OT winner.
Yeah.
Just went right through him.
Yeah. So I think that might be some rust, not having his first NHL game since last April. But I think he could work it around, become a solid backup for when Linus gets back. And I think they keep Marilainen down in the minors for a bit just to get him worked up, have him start 11 games there, see how it goes, or kind of maybe even it out.
Yeah. No. And Kyle and Sam talk a lot about this, but the depth of the Senators seems to be kind of an issue. Not as much on their NHL team, but kind of in the minors. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that they have the best prospect pool in the NHL. But, I mean, especially with goaltending, because I feel like this is not just a Senator-specific issue. I think plenty of teams don't really have deep goaltending depth all the way down. And it's such a unique position. You only carry two on your team, usually max three on your NHL team, right? So it's a really interesting position, and interesting when injuries happen and when players go on leave like this, who ends up getting these calls up and who gets re-signed. Because I mean, I'm pretty sure Malcolm Subban was on the Senators at some point last year. Like, it's random, and I kind of love it, honestly. Like these guys that are coming out of retirement is what it seems like.
I know.
Batman putting his cape back on.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, we're targeting Henrik Lundqvist next.
I saw he was warming up for like the alumni game or something, and I was like, he's coming back. But
he'd be better than Mad Sogard, that's for sure.
Well, what's up with Mad Sogard? He's still on the Senators, isn't he?
He's on Belleville. He's like perennial starter for Belleville, but every time we bring him up to the NHL, he gets scored on 8 times. So he's either got some development to go, or he's just not it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but I guess that all roads lead to beer league is what Sam says, so
it's true.
Yeah, no. But it does seem like the Senators are going to try to turn this around. The offense, like Dylan said, it looks great when it's humming, but they just need to get some goaltending.
Yeah.
Sanderson, despite his comments, looks fantastic. I mean, I think that the game where he had those comments, he had like a 4-point game something.
Night. 1 goal, 3 assists. Yeah. It was pretty impressive.
That is a huge night. But I really do hope the Sens can get back on track, because I mean, I think everyone likes it when the Sens are good at
Scrappy
the same time
Sens.
As the Habs, right?
Scrappy Sens, yeah.
I can just, if I can say one last thing.
Oh, absolutely.
I can just only imagine how this whole kind of debacle has impacted the locker room. Like, you have a lot of these young guys going through, you know, they have so far maybe been feeling like they're only getting better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And to have this real dry spell, I wonder if that's obviously is probably what cued those comments from Sanderson. But I wonder how much losing Ullmark has done to change the kind of dynamic in the locker room.
Oh, absolutely. I think it changes everything. I mean, it's just like it's just not stable. Like, you've got constant changes, right? Like, that can't be. I don't remember any team really having tremendous success when they have like 6 different goalies playing for them, or like players constantly moving up and down from the minors. Like, it seems like stability needs to be a core part of any successful franchise's season. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good that the Senators are getting this out of the way early in the season, because you really don't want this to happen post-trade deadline.
Yeah.
Like, then your season's kind of compromised, because like, coming down to the playoffs, like, you want to know who your guys are. You want to know who you can trust. Right now, I don't know if I would trust too many players on the Sens, goaltending-wise. I mean, I feel like the offense is definitely more stable.
100%.
Yeah. Okay, moving over to the NFL, we saw some exciting divisional round games.
Very exciting.
Sadly, my Buffalo Bills lost again. This is the third time on this podcast history that I've had to talk about the Bills losing in the playoffs, so it's kind of a tradition. But this one, I actually didn't watch the game. So AP, did you watch the game?
I did indeed. I watched the second half of
it.
I just flew back from California, and I was in Toronto Pearson Airport.
Yeah.
And I threw it on, and I was watching it. It was a heck of a game. It was back and forth all the way through, and then that final drive just... As a neutral football fan, coming from a Cincinnati Bengals fan, experienced lots of pain through that fan career, with the air quotes. And but just to watch it from a neutral point of view, I hate when refs decide games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Broncos were in no position for a field goal, which would have ended the game. The final score ends the game. The interception, the catch-terception, whatever you want to call it, I think it was an interception eventually. I think they made the right call. But to put a team in field goal range off a... Maybe it's a pass interference, maybe it's not. The first one I could say was arguable, but that's what drove the Broncos into field goal range, and that's what basically ended the game. Whatever Tre'Davious White did after was just supplementary onto that, but
it didn't make much of a difference.
That one call ended the game.
Dylan, did you get a chance to watch it, or were you watching the highlights? Because I was only watching the highlights. So
I did watch the game, and I don't know. I might disagree. I think as a hockey fan, I know that in the playoffs they kind of lean more on the. They lean more on the hesitant to call side. Mm-hmm. They give the players the benefit of the doubt. But I think it's the ref's job to make those calls, even if the implications are the Denver Broncos win the game. Now, whether it was actually passer interference is totally up for debate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that... just because those stakes are on the line doesn't mean a ref should make a call. I think if it was obvious, obviously it's the right thing to do. But you got to make a call. It's your job. It's why you're there.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think the frustration that a lot of people had is the game didn't seem to be called that strictly until that drive.
Yep.
Like, I completely agree with the point that playoffs are more important. Like, you got to kind of... I think it's less let the guys play and, like, you kind of got to be more on your job and do a good job.
Yeah.
But you can't pick and choose when you're doing a good job. And I do think that there were plays, like, throughout the game that could have gone both ways, like flags. Every NFL game, like, every snap could have holding, let's be completely honest.
Yeah.
But, like, I think the frustration was it just seems like almost out of nowhere all of a sudden – flag seemed to be going in one direction on the most important drive of the season.
Yeah.
So I do understand the frustration, but I mean, one thing that I feel like a lot of Bills fans are not considering is that Josh Allen turned the ball over 4 times himself, fumbled it 3 times, recovered it 1 time, didn't recover it the other 2, and then had 2 interceptions. And they still only lost by 3, but wow, you cannot do that in a playoff game and expect... to win, if you're being honest. And that was an issue for the Bills all season, was turnover differential, because the Bills turned the ball over more times than not, and that is concerning as a playoff team.
Yeah, it's like, a recipe for disaster in the playoffs.
I mean, James Cook couldn't hold on to the ball either. I mean, it's not just Josh Allen, but it did seem like it was like Denver has a very good defense, got to give the defense credit. But it also seems like Buffalo's got to hold on to the ball a little bit better in the most important game of the season. They weren't able to do it, but Denver took a pretty hard loss, too. They lost Bo Nix at the end of the game. He was going to kneel and blew out his ankle, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's done for the year.
Can't play anymore.
He's confirmed done for the year.
Confirmed done for the year. And Jared Stidham, I think, is the confirmed or the expected starter against the New England Patriots in the conference championship game. So talk about instability. I mean, Denver's going to have quite the unstable week in practice, I think.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And do you know who I blame this on? That little girl who's been picking the playoff games. She has 2 helmets in front of her, and for this specific game, she picked the Broncos, and then she picked the Bills, and she was 0-8 up until this time. So
everyone wrong, yeah.
Everyone wrong. So I think because she picked up the Broncos, Bo Nix broke his ankle.
Both teams lose.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 Now, as a Bills fan, I really hope the Patriots don't make it to the Super Bowl. I'm cheering for Jared Stidham as much as any Broncos fan this weekend. But the NFC had some good games too. I mean, we can talk about the Patriots winning against the Texans. I didn't think that game. I thought the game was the worst one out of all of them. I thought the Bears Rams game was insane because Caleb Williams forced overtime at the end of that with a crazy Hail Mary.
That was a crazy play.
But then the Rams did finish it off in overtime. I think a lot of people expected that. I don't think the Bears were a favorite in that game.
No.
And they're going up against the Seahawks. That game was like blowout too. I guess that one is more of a blowout because the Niners are so beat up with injuries that
just couldn't perform.
Yeah, no. And when you have so many injuries like that, I mean, it's scary to think about how good they would be if they did have all these players. but they still made it to the divisional round. But it was a good. Definitely not as good as Wild Card Weekend. I think Wild Card Weekend was awesome, and the divisional round was just kind of, it was meh.
It was okay. Honestly, the best game, in my opinion, was the Bills game, just because it was back and forth all game. There was turnovers, there was points. I do agree with you that the Rams-Bears game was insane, but it was insane in, like, streaks.
Yeah.
I remember we were down in the living room watching the game, and there was a portion of like the second and third quarter where no points were scored at all. It was just four and out, four and out, four and out, four and out.
Yeah,
so
boring football.
Until you get to the end and you get the most exciting football, but then again, you also had to go endure through that boring football to get there.
No, that is a good point. Yeah. Any predictions for the Super Bowl? Who's it going to be?
I think it's going to be the Patriots.
And? Who are they playing?
The Seahawks.
Patriots, Seahawks. You think the Patriots are winning?
I think the Patriots are beating the Seahawks. As much as I hate to say it.
I hate to hear it. Dylan, what do you think?
Is there some Patriots-Bills rivalry that I'm unaware of?
Yeah, Tom Brady kind of kicked Buffalo Bills fans' asses for his whole career.
He owned it for
And it hurt a lot. Watch Tom Brady play. And now I know Tom Brady's not there anymore, but New England just always has a sour taste in my mouth. And I hate if they were to make the Super Bowl before Josh Allen and the Bills made the Super Bowl, because I don't think Drake May is that good. I think it's Drake the Schedule May.
Wow.
I don't think he's an elite quarterback. I think he's top 20 at best.
Top 20.
I know people think he's an MVP, but he's not. It's Stafford. Stafford's the MVP. Let's be honest. And I mean, I just can't stand Robert Kraft either. I don't like
fair.
That guy either. I think he's an interesting owner, and I just don't feel like the Patriots deserve to be back having success this
so
quickly.
Soon.
Yes. Give them a couple years, and you know what? It might be a little...
Wait 31 years like the Bengals, you know?
Exactly. I'd be a little less stingy. But that, I would say that's the extent of my beef with the Patriots.
If the Patriots became a dynasty after we've had to deal with the Chiefs as well, the Bills always seem to have to fight through some real tough teams to make it.
Yeah, I really just wish the Bills were a tough team that other teams had to get through, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
You guys are always the underdog.
But yeah, no, I'm pretty much cheering anti-Patriots, so like I'd like the Seahawks to win. I don't really want the Rams to win just because they won so recently. But I guess I would say Denver is my Denver's the team I want to win. I think it's going to be Patriots, Seahawks, and I think the Seahawks are going to win. But that's just... I had the Seahawks going to the Super Bowl anyways and losing to the Bills.
Now, before we move on...
Whoa! That's a crazy line. We might have to clip that, guys. W chat, Aiden Peterson. Okay,
Sorry, one second. Do you mind if I ask you a question?
Dylan, say whatever you want. Say whatever you want.
Anything I want.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the Bills moving on from their head coach after he's brought them to be a perennial top 5, top 8 team in the league? Do you feel like that's the right move? Do you think it seems like they're committed to making it over the hump, even if it takes away from their floor here?
I disagree with the firing at this particular moment. There's been times where I've wanted Sean McDermott fired after this playoff game wasn't one of them, because I don't think he did a poor job coaching the playoffs or really this season. I thought he did a great job coaching this season. He's had much more questionable years. Like, there's been some calls where I'm like, really? Is that the play we're going with, Sean? Yeah. Is that what the decision we're making? So I was surprised, honestly. I thought, if any year he deserved to get off with, a slap on the wrist, it was this year. So I don't agree with it, because I do think him and Josh had a good relationship. I think McDermott had a good relationship with the entire team.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is, there are a lot of good coaches out there right now. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are getting scooped up. Harbaugh, Robert Saleh just got hired by the Titans. But Mike Tomlin's out
still
there.
Still on the table.
Mike McDaniel's out
excited
there.
For a 9-8 season?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you give Mike Tomlin Josh Allen, they're going 17-0. You heard it here first. I do think the Steelers, that situation's interesting because he didn't get fired. The Bills would have to trade for Tomlin. So they would probably have to give a second or third round pick. So I don't think that's going to happen for the Bills.
It's not very enticing.
Yeah. No, I've heard some rumors about John Gruden potentially being a replacement. Oh, so that would sources. Be a TikTok.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So
you
I
heard
think
it here first.
That might be a good one for the Bills to pick up. But Brian Daboll, who is a former Bills offensive coordinator, is also a free agent after getting fired from the Giants. Him and Josh had a good relationship when Josh was coming up. So that is who I think is the favorite to go and take over. It'll be an interesting offseason. Definitely a new look Bills team next year, coaching wise. I don't know what they're going to do in free agency. They usually do nothing. And I guess that's another thing, Dylan, is I don't agree that Brandon Bean, the general manager, is continuing to be the general manager of the Bills while Sean McDermott gets fired. I think both of them should have gone, or both of them should have stayed.
So you think they scapegoated him a little bit for the both of them?
I definitely think so. I definitely think so.
Do you think some personnel changes need to be made on the field?
I think the only personnel changes that I would propose for the Bills are better wide receivers. And that's not saying that the wide receivers we have aren't good. It's just saying there's no wide receiver one that can go up and make the crazy catches like a Puka Nacua or Devontae Adams can on the Rams. That is an ideal situation at wide receiver, or Devonta Smith and AJ Brown.
Yeah.
I love Khalil Shakir. I think he's a great wide receiver too. He's not a wide receiver one, and that's nothing he can do about it. I think he's a great receiver, but his ceiling is a wide receiver two.
Agreed.
And that's just it. You've got to go out and find that number one guy. I think George Pickens is that guy. And if there's somehow a chance that he doesn't re-sign with Dallas, I would be pursuing George Pickens with all of the, Bills don't have too much money to give George Pickens. So
as much as they can. Maybe.
As much as they can.
Yeah.
Now, we only have about 2 minutes left to talk about AFCON, but Mr. Mr. AP football expert, can we please get a quick recap?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll try to do this like an auctioneer.
Okay.
Basically, Morocco hosted the AFCON 2026, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the tournament, I only caught on to wins of this when Morocco played Nigeria in the semifinals. But throughout the tournament, there's been rumors that the Moroccan security has not been providing the other African nations proper protection. There was a video of the Senegalese team going down in a mall to their hotel, or I think it was an airport at one point. And they were being swarmed by fans. But the biggest kicker is the towel scandal. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but the Moroccan team throughout the entire tournament were stealing opposing goalies' towels during the game. And these towels were used to kind of dry their hands off when it was raining to make sure the ball doesn't slip. And there's a swath of clips on Instagram of ball boys, what looks like security guards, what looks like staff even in suits, jumping over the barrier, grabbing the towels, and jumping back. And there's a clip of the Nigerian keeper in the semifinals, which Nigeria lost to Morocco, basically getting a new towel, pointing a middle finger at the ball boys and the staff, putting the towel down, and then 2 seconds later, the ball boys are talking to each other. You can see them.
Mm-hmm.
One of them jumps over the fence and steals the towel. And their excuse for this was that they were performing voodoo on the towels. Witchcraft. So, believe it or not. But the thing carried over into the final against Senegal. And they were watching tape, so the Senegalese backup was actually holding these towels. And he got jumped, basically, by the ball boys for a towel. And they chased him around the sidelines as he was holding the towel.
which was ridiculous. Senegal ended up winning the game. There's a couple of called goals and a penalty, but it was quite an interesting and almost disastrous final. But
I heard that there was some controversy to deal with the end of the game.
Big time, big time. There was a disallowed goal against Senegal where Hakimi, a Moroccan player, seemed to go down quite easily, in my opinion. And they called this a foul and therefore disallowed the goal. 6 minutes later, they call a penalty, which I do think was a penalty. And this caused the Senegalese fans to freak out. So they were fighting with police with riot chants.